The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. 5,000 years of wisdom on demand. Check out 3 free episodes of Gaia's great content at jimherald.com/Gaia. That's jimherald.com/Gaia. Thanks, Gaia.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harold and so glad to be with you once again. And I think you're going to love this show because we're going to talk to Steph Young. She writes under the pen name Stephen Young, and her most recent book is Stalked in the Woods, Creepy True Stories, Scary Encounters in the Woods. I think you're going to enjoy that. And she has a great voice to boot. And then in part two, we're not letting up. Tony Kail will join us to talk about a secret history of Memphis hoodoo, root workers, conjurers, and spirituals. So I think you're going to enjoy this show. And before we get to it, I would ask one favor. Please, please, please subscribe, rate, and review the free shows. I would very much appreciate it, the Paranormal Podcast and Campfire. And that entails, if you're listening on iTunes or the podcasts app on your iPad or your iPhone, you just go in there, search for the shows, and hit subscribe. That will boost our numbers and help us. And then a nice rating and review would be fantastic as well. That way, when people run across us in the directory, they'll say, hey, I'll give that Jim Harold guy a try. We'd appreciate very much. And if you listen elsewhere, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever they let you do so. We thank you so much. And now let's move on to spooky things in the woods and Memphis hoodoo. On this edition, we're going to talk about spooky stories, being stalked in the woods. Our guest today is Steph Young. She is the author under the pen name Stephen Young of multiple books, including her latest Stalked in the Woods, Creepy True Stories, Creepy Tales of Scary Encounters in the Woods. And I think this is going to be a very, very popular show. People are going to really enjoy it. Steph is an independent researcher addicted to researching all supernatural, paranormal, esoteric, and enigmatic mysteries. Each book she writes seems to lead her to further questions and searches for answers as the unexplained mysteries inevitably deepen and develop into ever more complex riddles in the spectrum of the unknown. She's been a guest on Coast to Coast AM, as well as many other radio shows and YouTube programs, including being a regular guest on Where Did the Road Go with Soraya. Good guy. Great show. Appearances on Midnight in the Desert, on Howard Hughes' The Unexplained UK Talk Radio, The Higher Side Chats, and Darkness Radio with Dave and Tim. Steph, welcome to the program today.
Hello. Thank you so much for asking me on. It's an absolute honor to come on your show.
Oh, that's very sweet of you. Thank you very much. It's an honor to have you on the show. Now, and it's been too long. We should have had you on a long time ago. So let me ask you, how did you get into all this stuff?
Well, I started off writing magazine articles, and I hadn't really been a writer before, but I used to buy these magazines about spiritual and supernatural occurrences. And then one day I thought I'd really like to see if I could write an article. So I wrote something about creepy creatures in the woods. And then I was gathering all this information and I really wanted to start putting it into books. So that's how I sort of became able to do it.
So what frightens us about the woods? Why are the woods so spooky?
Because there's so many strange things in the woods, so many strange encounters with creatures or monsters or things that we just can't explain what they are.
Now, how do you get these stories? I mean, I do the Campfire show and I have the Campfire book, so I have a certain way I get my stories. How do you find your stories?
Well, a lot of it is archive research, so looking in really old newspapers, looking in old books, going through a multitude of forums and sites and things. That's probably how I started off at first. And then you'll come across a particular story that's been reported in the newspapers. One was about a man called David Stone recently that I was looking into, and that's about 20 years old. And so you can spend weeks investigating a case. And then sometimes, as I've written more books, people now contact me and say, well, that story that you were writing about really reminds me about something that happened to me. And so they start to tell me about the experience. And so I do get probably more reader accounts now, or listener accounts as well. So it's kind of a mix, because I really love to do investigations into really strange stories. So I can be off for weeks doing that, but then I've also got these amazing stories that people send in.
Do you feel that there's something mystical about the forest, about the woods?
Well, I was looking into cases that I found in the newspaper, but they were in Malaysia, and this was only last year. And one case, for example, there were a group of boys, and they were on holiday in the forest with their families. And they wanted to go on a long hike, but their families didn't really want to go. So the parents said, well, you go on the hike and we'll meet you at the other end. And one of the fathers was going to meet them. Well, they disappeared. So they sent in the troops. They sent the scouts in. They had hundreds of people looking for them. Nobody could find them. And in fact, the scout group traversed or rappelled down a sort of canyon and across and back up another one. Eventually, they found the boys. So they were fine. There was nothing wrong with them. And when the parents said to them what happened, they said, well, we heard this really beautiful music. So we were following the music. And as we followed it, the forest kind of changed into something completely different. And it was open and wide and green. Well, the path that they'd been on was completely covered in mud because there'd been a landslide. So that didn't make any sense. And it also didn't make any sense how they could have got from one side of the sort of canyon bit to the other. Well, a parapsychologist, a doctor over there, had actually reported on the case. And he said, well, we can't explain how they got from one side to the other, but I will tell you this. When the searchers were looking for them, they had a helicopter up in the air, and the helicopter sighted a tiger on the path that the boys would have been on. So this doctor said, I believe that something supernatural intervened to get the boys away from the tiger, because the tiger would have mauled them or eaten them. So sometimes there seems to be almost like good or bad, but some kind of supernatural intervention. I remember a case I found that had happened years ago, and a woman and her boyfriend had been hiking on the Pacific coast. The boyfriend had grown up there. It was a part of California, and he wanted to show his now fiance where he'd hiked. So he took her up, and then he decided to take them back down. But they took a path that was really only suitable for animals. So as they were going down, he was in front of her, and he would turn around and check she was okay. And he turned around one more time, and it had started to rain, and he lost his footing and he fell to his death.
Oh.
Well, she declares, and I found the reports, she declares that something came from the sky above her and enveloped her as though it was giant wings. So somehow or other, she says, she managed to get down to the bottom and was safe. But the searchers, when they came to see what had happened, to investigate, said there's no way a person could have got down the path that they were taking, because it wasn't a path. So you have these stories where it seems like there's really positive encounters, although, of course, the boyfriend had died. And then you have the more darker encounters as well. So there does seem to be a lot of mystical things that happen as well in the forests.
Now, your stories, do they fall primarily like the strange animal? Is it the ghostly? Is it UFO? Is it kind of an amalgam of all those things? Do you see? Go ahead.
It's everything. Because when I was writing a couple of the earlier books, I was trying to determine what's going on. And what you find is that you look at a particular area. I was looking at Macawassee Stone Forest in Peru. I was looking at a forest in Ireland. In both cases, you would have paranormal sightings. You'd also have strange lights in the sky. There was, in some of the areas, a preponderance of ley lines, which supposedly has some kind of energy under the ground. you'd have accounts of people being abducted and finding themselves inside of a cave or inside of some kind of craft. So when you think it might be a clear-cut case, oh, they were taken away, and you find that there's a convergence of all of these different things happening in the same area. And in fact, in one place in England called Todmorden, where there'd been a man had disappeared. He'd gone out of his house in a tiny village, and he had disappeared. He was found about 5 days later on the top of a coal pile, and he had a strange marking on his body that, in fact, the coroner read out the report and said in the autopsy that there was no way that they could identify what this substance was that was on top of the mark found on his body. So you would think, well, he's probably been abducted, you know. And in fact, the policeman who found the body later was looking for some lost sheep, because some sheep had disappeared as well. And when he was in his car, his car stopped working, and he seemed to lose some time. And then he noticed that the boots of his soles of his boots were split open as though he'd been dragged along. And he said, through hypno-regression, that he'd actually found himself in a dark room with biblical figures and a robotic character and really big black dogs. Well, an investigator about 20 years ago, I think, was looking into that specific area. And he said that he'd taken a group of psychics, but not told them anything that had happened in any of the incidents, because there'd been a lot around there. Each of the psychics were able to say what had happened, and he believed that it was due to the ley lines in the ground. But then it gets even weirder, because he said there was a lot of witchcraft in the area, and he believed that these ley lines had been deliberately blackened. So there's a way, apparently, that you could sort of hold rituals, harnessing this positive energy and turning it black, and that you would then manifest these negative experiences. Whereas if you go to other places that have sort of got healing qualities, you can be healed. So I'm probably rambling on, actually.
No. Tell your stories.
So I think what I'm trying to say is that you can go from something very simple, and it just gets deeper and deeper, and you can't really find a straight answer at all. It just gets more incredible, and there's more possibilities.
It's interesting, because you're a collector of stories. I'm a collector of stories, and after a while, sometimes you become immune to some of these stories. You know, like, I've heard them like that. What story have you heard recently that has shocked or surprised you, or maybe even kind of frightened you a little bit?
One that was really, really strange, is a lady called Catherine had written to me, because I'd been talking on a radio show. I'd been asked about the preponderance of clown sightings, and I'm in correspondence with a person who said that he'd been tormented as a child and onward into adulthood by sightings of a harlequin in his house. Well, I was talking about that and how he had told me that he believed it was to do, that the clowns could quite possibly be behind some disappearances of people and children. And so when I was talking about that, Catherine had written to me, and what she described was that she'd been in the woods in England, because we were talking about the wild hunt in folklore, and she'd said, well, I can send you a book and you'll find out more about the wild hunt, but let me tell you my experience. And she'd been in northern England in the woods when she said that she was with a friend, and they were camping. And they'd built up a fire, and they suddenly had this sighting of what looked like two very strange creatures, which I asked her to explain, because she said that they had roots for feet. So they were very tall, very slender, jet black, and they had roots instead of feet. And she said they followed us back to the campsite, and they only stopped at the boundary. So we built up the fire like crazy, because we felt that this was the right thing to do, that maybe it would keep them out. And she said, but even though we did that, we couldn't really get the fire going, and we could see them pacing the boundary. And I said to her, well, what did they look like? And she drew me some pictures. They actually look like an old-fashioned style dressed woman with a dress with a big bustle that goes down to the feet and with some kind of cap or hat on. And I said, well, were they solid or semi-solid, and how were they moving? Because I'd also been speaking about these black stick men type people. Well, she said they were very large, upright, and really that they were solid black. There was no transparency, but their movement was very weird, she said, because it was almost like they didn't move so much as they shifted, and they would be in one place and then move forward to another part, but very, very quickly. And you didn't really see the movement. She said, I don't recall the roots moving like feet at all, but they were so fast. And she said, we had this feeling that we shouldn't be there. So obviously they left as quickly as they could, kept looking around behind them. And she said what was strange was that they crossed the stream with no problem at all. And she said, I thought something like that wouldn't be able to get across water. She said, but they moved very fluidly across the water. And she said, they felt to me as though they had a sense of intelligence about them. And that's what I find in a lot of the accounts that I get. There's a lady who wrote to me a couple of years ago called Susie, and she had felt the same thing about these, whatever they are, having an intelligence. So she had said that she had gone to move to her sisters in a wooded subdivision in Hampshire in America. And she used to go out onto the porch at night to have a cigarette, sort of about midnight. And it was very rural where they were, but the porch light would be on, and she could see into the woods. The woods surrounded the house. But every night she would hear the breaking of sticks. So after the first couple of nights, it sounded like they were getting closer and closer to the house. So she sent her sister's son, who was about 12, in the daylight out into the woods and got him to jump on sticks and try and make that sound so that she could work out, well, how heavy is this thing that's breaking the sticks? And she added that her parents were camp leaders, so she grew up camping. And she said, I've told people before about this. And of course, they say it was Bigfoot. They say it was a fox, a coyote. She said, I know every single sound that the creatures in the woods can make. But she said what they were doing, they were coming closer all the time, but they were breaking sticks. So one sounded like it was at the front of the house and one would be around the back. And they used to get closer and closer. And at one point, one night, she could see that something, well, it was invisible, but it was coming up the stairs of the porch because they had potted flowers on the porch. She saw the flowers be parted as it came up the steps towards her, and she just fled. But she believed, I mean, she was so shaken up that she was adamant that these things had an intelligence, because they were, in her mind, they were coordinating their movements. Right. And she felt that she said, you know, are they just observing us? And she even said, well, the noise that they make, is it a noise that's actually coming from them, not the sticks? But she... So I suppose, you see, I'm newer to this, a lot newer than you are, Jim. So you've been getting accounts for many, many years. And of course, I'm newer to this. So I, you know, each one blows my mind. Sometimes you think, well, I'm not sure about that one. I'm not sure. So maybe it won't, you know, it won't go in the books, or I won't look into it further. But a lot of them... For a lot of people that send them in, they don't really want me to put them in the books. And I have to coax. I have to coax them.
They just want to share it with them. I think people have a need to share these things, because you take it seriously, I take it seriously, and my listeners take it seriously. But I think there's many times that a lot of people don't take them seriously. So I think that it kind of fills a void, in the sense that people feel there's someone that they can talk to about these things. It's not going to judge them or laugh at them or make fun of them.
That's exactly it. And yes, I mean, Susie in Susie's case, actually, she was slightly different because she really wanted the word out because she was so terrified. But a lot of times, I mean, I can probably get ridiculed myself because I've been speaking to somebody who tells me that he has little people and fairy encounters. So I don't dismiss that and I don't ridicule it. But the problem is that, yes, of course, a lot of people would. So for somebody to be able to say that to you, and when he was telling me, the reason why I do believe him is he gave me such precise descriptions. He said at one point, these little fairy creatures, who actually, he says, do want people to know about them and hate the fact that they get ridiculed. He said at one point, you know, door stops where you can keep a door open a sure. little. Yeah. So he said two of them were on this door stop. He said, but they were defying gravity. They weren't, they were dancing. They were dancing around and around in a circle, but they weren't standing upright. They were on the edge at a 45 degree angle, going round and round and round dancing. Now, of course, that sounds absolutely insane, but it takes either a very great imagination to even think of that as an image to send to say that, you know, this is what they do, or there's something there that's actually pretty significant and it's true, because I'd find it hard to come up with something like that. I would have said, I see them dancing in the room. You know, I wouldn't think about a doorknob and a 45 degree and how they're defying gravity and, you know, so
yeah, exactly.
some of these stories have things that I could never make up if I was a fiction writer, which to me lends more credence to it.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And we are enjoying our conversation with Steph Young. We're talking about spooky stories in the woods, creepy true stories. And we'll be back right after this. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. Keep listening because I'm going to tell you how you can sample some of the best programming Gaia has to offer for free. Now, you're listening to this program, and that means you love this type of information, these unexplained topics, the paranormal, ancient mysteries, all of these things. You want the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. But where do you go if you want a streaming TV service that's dedicated to all of these topics we love? Well, the answer is simply Gaia. Gaia explores the topics we enjoy. And it's always providing viewers with tremendous new content. Now, I've been telling you the last several months about all of the great shows that Gaia has to offer. But now I can tell you that you can check out 3 free episodes of some of the best programming Gaia has ever offered. And that's over at jimherold.com/Gaia. That's jimherold.com/Gaia. You'll see Buzzsaw, hosted by Sean Stone, talking about forbidden knowledge for a new age. Beyond Belief, hosted by George Norrie, the truth on UFO case files. And Truth Hunter, hosted by Linda Moulton Howe, the unheard truth behind Roswell's UFOs. And you can find all 3 of those episodes, the links for them, to watch them absolutely free at jimherold.com/Gaia. Now, let's say you've taken the plunge and you've said, yeah, I am going to sign up to Gaia. What kind of new things could you see this week? Well, let me tell you about some of those. You would see Wisdom Teachings, hosted by David Wilcock, and he's going to talk about space domains in the unified field. Beyond Belief is joined by Lynn Buchanan, and he was a remote viewer. Lynn was Revelations from Remote Viewing. Fascinating stuff. Missing Links, Greg Braden, talking about awakening the heart-brain union, and so much more. So do me a favor, doesn't cost you a penny. Go over to jimherold.com/Gaia. That's jimherold.com/Gaia. There you will find 3 free episodes. You'll see what I'm talking about. There's no charge. Check it out. See what you think. I think you'll love it. Thank you so much for listening. And thanks, Gaia. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast, and today we're in the woods, the spooky woods, and we're actually talking to Steph Young about her series of books on spooky stories, creepy true stories in the woods, the most recent one being Stalked in the Woods, Creepy True Stories, Creepy Tales of Scary Encounters in the Woods. Now, Steph, one thing you cover straight away to borrow from your countryman phrase. Chapter one, The Vanishings. Now, I know David Paulides has done a lot of work with his Missing 411 series with the strange disappearances. What have you found?
Well, do you know, the ones that really get me are the ones that have got some really strange clues left behind. So, as an example, there's the case of David Stone, who this was reported in the Prescott Courier in Arizona back in 1988. And it was the night of Halloween when a man called Larry Rivers was driving along a dirt road in the desert when he came across a man walking. So slowing the car down and opening his window, he asked the man, "What are you doing?" And the man said, "I'm looking for the beast." So the man on foot was David Stone. And he was wearing just a t-shirt and shorts, although it was nearly winter. But this was believed to be the last time that he was seen alive. Nearly a week later, he was reported missing. And his remains were not found until 4 years later, when three hunters came across them. Well, the deputy sheriff at the time, William Cavalier, said it's just about the strangest thing that's ever happened, because the search for him was absolutely massive, and it included planes flying over, horses, bloodhounds, but there was no sign of him. And his tracks were found, but it appeared that they stopped. Although quite close to the highway, they just stopped. Well, he'd been en route to be a best man at a friend's wedding. So when his father discovered he hadn't arrived at the wedding, his father contacted all of the sheriff's offices from the home in San Diego up to El Paso, but none of them had received any reports about the missing man. But then the local sheriffs did subsequently come across his car. So his car was parked at a really strange angle, and this is in New Mexico, nearly 15 miles from a road called Forks Road. Well, the search had gone on for 2 weeks, and it was then called off. Mm-hmm. So he'd absolutely vanished. His remains were found by the hunters 4 years later, and they thought at first it was animal bones, but they were human. The pathologist said there's no trauma, so there's no way that we can say that he received injury at the time of his death, or that it caused his death was caused by an injury. All of his personal items were gone, just his shoes remained, but actually there wasn't much left of them. Well, the reason it was so strange, though, was because he'd left some really weird clues. When they picked up on his car, he'd left it close to some pyramid-shaped mountains. And as the searchers followed this initial trail northwest from the car, they came across a pile of small rocks that had been formed into a pyramid shape and enclosed in a triangle of other rocks. Then, the next day, they came across another pyramid of rocks further on, and beside this pyramid was the man's missing Rolex watch. Well, he'd been a stockbroker, so he could afford a Rolex. Well, a couple of miles further on, they discovered in the sand the Fibonacci sequence. But instead of it ending, so it should have gone on and on up to the number 21, but it ended at number 18. So it was an error. And his father said, "This to me looks more like a deliberate error," because he obviously was very bright. So his father thought, well, was he leaving some kind of clue to say, "I'm in trouble and I need help"? But if so, why? The bloodhounds led the searchers on a 13-mile trek from there, and then his footprint stopped. And in his car, they found a note, and the note said, "They think the word is in the safe. 6 knives in Rob's room. You buy your tea and you take your chances. Halloween." Huh. What on earth did the note mean? Why was he leaving those strange formations? What did he make an error on purpose? Was he being abducted? But where had his body been for 4 years? Because it ended up being back in the same place. So it's cases like that that I just find, I mean, obviously it's a tragedy as well, but it's so fascinating.
It's very, very strange.
Yeah. And I came across one, about a man called Don Kemp. And this one is astonishing because it covers, well, he was looking into the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, but he disappeared en route in Wyoming on his way to find somewhere quiet to write his book. And the case itself includes a strange hole in his skull, the missing bone in his back of his throat, a doctor from the Smithsonian asking to see the body when it was found 4 years later, again in exactly the same place that it had gone missing, and the trail of his footprints had gone and stopped, and nobody could find him 4 years before, but then 4 years later he's found. His body's pristine, not a mark on it, so he hadn't been buried somewhere in the bad weather. The doctor at the Smithsonian says, we cannot find any tool that would make the hole in his head. His sister said, well, I was contacted by a scientist and a group of paranormal investigators in the area who said that cows were going missing, and it was the aliens. His sister said, before Don disappeared, he gave her a book about the mysteries of the universe, but it opened to a page about the Pleiadians and said, I have a feeling you might need this one day. Before he disappeared, they went to a seance, and the women who conducted the seance knew everything about them. And then during the seance, the psychic, the red line appeared, and it looked like her throat was being cut, and she started choking. When his body was found, his mother asked one of his friends to go to where he'd left his car and to drive it back to Maryland. When the friend parked overnight in a motel, the car was broken into, and a lot of his research papers on Abraham Lincoln were stolen. When it was driven back to the family home, it was broken into again, more was taken. Then they had some audio tapes left and a little bit more research. They gave it to a historian. He ended up dying in his house when the house was on fire and the notes disappeared. They gave it to a Civil War store owner. He ended up dying in an accident and the notes disappeared. So it just went on and on and on, and there was no resolution. So you think, well, what did it have something to do with Abraham Lincoln? Were they trying to stop him revealing what he'd found out? Or was it really something to do with the Pleiadians? Or, you know, there's so many different ways it could have been answered, but such a mystery.
It is a mystery. It is a mystery. Now, let me ask you this, because I'm interested. I'm not going to tell you my opinion, and I want to get your opinion, and then I'll chime in. What do you think is behind all of this?
Oh, gosh. Well, I kind of wonder about the interdimensional side of it, because, for example, somebody called Matt DeMille, who's a distant relative to the Hollywood DeMille who used to make the old black and white.
Cecil B. DeMille.
Yeah, yeah. So he'd contacted me because actually I'd been writing about a particular area in Assinet Ledge that has this really terrible reputation for an awful feeling coming over people and it making them feel that want to throw themselves off this ledge. Anyway, he had contacted me about this, and it boiled down that he had a long story to tell me. He is adamant that he was somehow disappeared as a school child in front of people. And he ended up in a place, he said it was almost as though, if you'd have said to me, what's a fairy abduction like, and you go to fairyland, he said, that's what it felt like, but it wasn't. It was artificial. So his belief is that he was something to do, let's say, with the Montauk MK Ultra sort of side of things, mm-hmm. You know, the Montauk boys where something artificial is giving you this impression that you're in a different alternative timeline or different dimension. Well, I've done a lot of research into cases where people believe that they've gone into other dimensions. So whether there are naturally occurring dimensions, whether they can be somehow created and people go into them because it's an experiment, I don't know about that, because it's all of these things are quite outlandish, aren't they? But if I could put money on it, I wouldn't know. But I do wonder about this sort of dimensional thing. Although people say, well, you know, maybe the stones and the magnetic qualities and things, I don't know if I really believe that you can just wander off and end up in a different dimension. And yet there are so many accounts. A man from the outback of Australia wrote to me recently, and he used to live on a property about 10 years ago, way out in the outback. He knew the property like the back of his hand. He's also a very ardent skeptic. He religiously disproves Yowie sightings, saying it's a dog. So he doesn't believe in all of this. But he went out to shoot some roo on his property. Somehow or other, he ended up in an area that he's never seen before. He lost time. He ended up soaking wet. He'd shot his air into the shot his gun into the air as a signal that he needed help. His neighbour and his girlfriend didn't hear the shots. He ended up somehow getting back home, but he'd actually crossed a boundary fence without knowing that he'd crossed the fence. So somehow it was almost like he was transported to a different world, and then he came back, you know.
It's very strange, very strange.
And
I guess this is my point. And I've said this many times on the show, so if people have heard this, I apologize. But, you know, when I first started looking at this stuff, and I mean, I've been interested in it my whole life and started podcasting almost 12 years ago now. But the thing is that I looked at it originally as very siloed. Like, I was interested in all of it. I had a level of belief in all of it. Some things more, unless I'm a little less of a Bigfoot believer, a little more of a ghost and UFO believer. But anyway, I had a level of belief in all of it, but I thought it was all siloed and in no way attached. That, you know, UFOs were over here and it was totally discreet from ghosts, which is totally discreet from cryptids, that it was all separated. Mm. The more I get into this and the more I talk to other people, it seems to me that somehow maybe all of this stuff is on some meta level somehow connected. What are your thoughts on that? Is all of this stuff totally separate, or do you think it's somehow connected?
I think a lot of people say that it's down to your perception. So I've heard the theory that, okay, you think you're looking at the Wendigo, or you think you're looking at Bigfoot, but you're not. It's an alien in disguise. My argument to that is, it's hard to agree with that when you come face to face with the Wendigo in the middle of nowhere and it's going to attack you. So this sounds a bit silly, but so what I'm trying to say is that if I had an encounter in the woods and it looked very much to me like a creature I'd never seen before and it looked horrifying, I would think I wouldn't believe or I wouldn't agree with the theory that all of these things are one and the same thing, you see? So I think that's the difficulty I have. I understand the theory is that you may see something and somebody else will have the same experience and they'll see something else entirely. So it's all connected and it's all one thing and something is manifesting these things and your perception will interpret it as an alien, as Bigfoot. But then I think, yeah, but imagine if you're the one that has this experience. You know, I've had a couple of strange experiences and you couldn't tell me it's any different from what I saw. So I guess that's the difficulty. You know, we have all these encounters and these experiences. If you tried to say to somebody, look, hold on, I know you think it was an alien abducting you, but it wasn't. It was a demon. The problem is that they won't be able to be talked into believing that because there's a theory that says this is all one unified belief. But I'm not against it being a unified thing and these, whatever they are, having the ability to manifest as different things, if that makes sense.
Now, the woods, one thing that we associate the woods with and we talk about on these shows are Bigfoot or Sasquatch. What do you think about Bigfoot and Sasquatch?
Well, that's the thing. I don't know, because the idea is that they're not terrestrial and that there's lots of accounts where they just simply disappear in front of your eyes, or they seem to go and suddenly disappear into the ground, that sort of thing. Some people can communicate, but I've had lots of conversations with researchers who are able to communicate with them in some way. But where do they come from? I feel as though they probably do exist, yeah. It's not an area that I've really gone into myself, because I kind of think so many people are experts on it, but probably will do more on it. But I don't know. I don't know. What do you think?
You know, I that's one of the ones that I'm really kind of skeptical about in general. In other words, if somebody said to me, okay, what do you think the percentage chance that UFOs represent something real? I would put it in my mind about 80%. And I would put ghosts and near-death experiences and stuff like that, I put that at about 90%. Bigfoot, I'd put it at about 30%. But it's still enough to believe that it is possible. Now, I tend to be very much a traditionalist in that regard. I think when people are seeing these animals, that maybe there's some kind of undiscovered animal, some undiscovered species. But then you've got the whole other side of the fence, which you were referring to, the whole idea that maybe the reason we never find any remains or DNA or scat or anything like that from a Bigfoot or Sasquatch is because they're interdimensional travelers. And that one for me is maybe a bridge too far. But again, I've got kind of very, I tend to think very almost, even though I believe in supernatural stuff, I'm very kind of materialistic in a lot of my thinking, kind of very traditional. So for me, it's kind of hard to wrap my mind around the idea that, you know, Sasquatch is popping in and out from another dimension. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's invalid. That's just kind of the limitations of my own mind.
What I'd really like to ask you, I'm obsessed with accounts about hearing screams in the woods. So I've got lots of stories of people having heard this screaming, but there's nothing attached to the scream. So I'm really obsessed with screaming, disembodied screams, and nothing being there, and also with these invisible sort of things. So what have you come across? Lots of accounts where people hear screaming, but there's never anything there, but it's terrifying.
Yeah, it certainly is. And
what could be doing it? What do you think could be doing it?
Well, the thing is that there's been talk of a language, talk of families and chatter. We've had guests on who have played sound and said that they're families. I really don't know. And I think, I hate to say this, but it's kind of my conclusion when somebody says, well, what do you think? And my ultimate answer is, I don't know. And I bet you find the same thing. You know, it's one of those things, the more, and you, in your intro on your website, you even kind of say it, the deeper you get into this, the more it pulls you in. And, you know, when I started, I said, I'm going to be doing this for 6 months and I am going to interview all these great people. And, you know, I'll have this stuff figured out. Well, the truth is 12 years in, every show I do opens up new questions. So it's kind of like a hamster on a wheel, but I enjoy running on it. So, and it has certainly been a lot of fun to talk to you today, Steph Young, and your series of books. Now, I also understand upcoming for you a podcast.
Yeah, it's going to be on Deprogrammed Radio. It's going to be called Creepy Unexplained Mysteries, and it's probably going to go out as well under the Where Did the Road Go on YouTube. So there'll be several ways that people can listen. I haven't done this before, so I'm not a veteran like you, so I'm going to try my best.
I wasn't a veteran when I started, and you have a fantastic voice and way of telling stories. I'm sure it's going to be very, very successful. And tell us about the books, where we can find the books and what books are out there.
Well, they're on Amazon, so lots of woods books and also haunted asylums, demons, lots of things really. And I've got a website now, which is stephyoungauthor.com.
And by the way, if you find Stephen Young, that's Steph. That's just, yes. That's just a pen name. So if you find Stephen Young and you see these haunted in the woods, dead in the water, forever awake, panic in the woods, I'm looking here. Something in the woods is taking people, haunted asylums, morgues, and cemeteries under Stephen Young. That's actually Steph. So, Steph, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it, and best of luck with all your books, your new podcast, and everything you do.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure talking with you. Really honored. Thank you, Jim.
Wow, what a great guest. Great stories. A great voice, I must say, once again. It goes without repeating. And now we are going to have another great guest. Tony Cale is going to talk to us about a secret history of Memphis hoodoo, root workers, conjurers, and spirituals. And here it is. The topic today is hoodoo, specifically a secret history of Memphis hoodoo, root workers, conjurers, and spirituals. And we have the author of a new book by that name, Tony Kale, and we're so glad to have him with us. He is an ethnographer and writer. He holds a degree in cultural anthropology and has researched magico-religious cultures for more than 25 years. His work has taken him from voodoo ceremonies in New Orleans to Haitian botanicas in Harlem and spiritual churches in East Africa. He has lectured at more than 100 universities, hospitals, and public safety agencies and been featured on CNN Online, the History Channel, and numerous radio, television, and print outlets. A resident of Tennessee, Tony was raised in Memphis and calls it his second home. Tony, welcome to the program today.
Hey, good to be with you.
So, I mean, it seems like you came by this very honestly and being a Tennessean and your background in Memphis. Why specifically, though, why did you want to look at hoodoo?
Well, you know, Jim, it was something that was already present in the region growing up as a child in Memphis. There were groceries and thrift stores that carried some of the different hoodoo curio products like candles and oils. And as a child, I really didn't know a whole lot about it. Years later, I would go on to meet a lady that actually lived rather close to me that was a traditional root worker. And I started going and visiting her and interviewing her and sort of documenting some of what she did. And again, at the time, it really didn't take hold. Well, a number of years later, I had an opportunity to do some work in Africa, and the study of African traditional religions is sort of a personal passion for me. And I started seeing these very direct parallels between Southern hoodoo that we saw in Memphis and throughout the Mississippi Delta and practices in Africa. And as I started doing research on hoodoo in Memphis and slowly peeling back the layers, I discovered this, for lack of a better term, a secret history of root workers and hoodoo practitioners in Memphis, and just a number of historical events, significance in Memphis history that I had no idea were related to hoodoo.
Now, a lot of people talk about voodoo, and very familiar with that term in pop culture and so forth. Maybe they've heard hoodoo, but they're like, is it the same thing? Is it a variation? Is it totally different? So talk about the compare and contrast the idea of voodoo as opposed to hoodoo.
Sure. And that is a common, I guess, misidentification of hoodoo. And we've even seen that here in the South. Voodoo itself is actually a religion. It focuses on gods and goddesses and spirits of nature, and it is a religious practice. Hoodoo is more of a system of magic. It's a collection of different practices related to root work, amulets and charms, sometimes healing, sometimes conjuring, but voodoo and hoodoo are two very different systems. Now, one of the phenomena that we did see back in the early 1900s in Memphis was where hoodoo was commonly referred to as voodooism or voodoo in the press. And many times this was sort of used as an insult because the inference was that the activity, particularly out of New Orleans, was of some sort of destructive voodoo practice that included everything from animal to human sacrifice. And so the term voodoo in the press in the South was used many times to sort of paint a very malevolent picture of this traditional tradition of hoodoo.
I'll give you a perfect example. I mean, everybody's familiar with the, if you talk about voodoo, which it sounds like to me, they just threw it in one big bowl and just called it voodoo. I mean, the outsiders or people who were against it, maybe for religious reasons, those kind of things, tried to vilify it and just called it all voodoo. And then equate that with something like very big in popular culture. Again, voodoo dolls, the idea that, you know, this conjuring was of the devil. It was destructive. It was trying to hurt people. So I guess my question is this. When you look at the practice, let's set voodoo aside. Let's talk about hoodoo. When you set that aside, in looking at hoodoo, how much of the activity would you view as positive? And is there a negative aspect? I mean, are we talking about 90% is all for good stuff and 10% may be a little less so? What? How does that break down?
We know there's traditionally been sort of a line separating the role of what would be known as a root worker that does positive work with roots and herbs and has the ability to not only apply herbs in a biological sense to clients who may be sick and in need of healing, but may also be able to apply various spiritual energies from these herbs. There's always been sort of a line between what's known as the root worker and the conjurer. The conjurer typically was that person who performed forms of sometimes aggressive magic. For instance, if you're needing a job that someone else has, you might go to the conjurer, and the conjurer may be able to, through a series of rituals, remove the person from that position so you may get that job. But the majority of hoodoo practitioners were very positive. They were providing services to the community. In fact, at the very root of where root work and hoodoo developed out of was the practice of traditional medicine on plantations throughout the South, because many of the slaves would receive very little, if any, medical treatment, and living in these adverse physical conditions and getting diseases and sicknesses like dysentery and the yellow fever, there was very little help for slaves. But there were those traditional healers who had been brought from Africa, kidnapped through slavery, and now found themselves on plantations, where they were able to take various plants and bark from trees and different healing techniques and apply them for health and good. So hoodoo, although it does sort of carry a taboo imagery to some people, is predominantly very positive and used for healing and used for luck and used for love. But again, I think a lot of the negative aspects that's been attached to hoodoo actually came through some of the earlier press back in the late 1800s and early 1900s.
Now, when we talk about hoodoo, I know that there's talk of some of these spiritual traditions kind of being intermingled. You know, maybe parts of these come from the slave culture. Parts of it are kind of intermingled with Christian iconography and those kind of things. Is that the case with hoodoo?
Yes, very much so. In fact, on many of the plantations, slaves encountered new forms of religion, including, particularly in the South, Protestant Christianity. And so you started to see this melding together of these two cultures. For example, a traditional healer might initially use roots and herbs. Well, now they might combine that with reading verses out of the Psalms, out of the Bible, or using Christian terminology with their practice. And some researchers believe that these two different cultures melded together sometimes out of survival and sometimes because there was sort of a philosophy of whatever works. So if this aspect of this Christian religion works and this aspect of African traditional religion works, why not utilize both of them? And we saw in areas too, particularly in Mississippi, where there were elements of Native American traditions combined with some of the African traditions. And there's actually early record of folklorists going into the Delta and doing research with families and being able to identify specific Native American practices mixed in with these African traditional practices.
Now, you talk in the book about a war on hoodoo, and I could see years ago, maybe folks, particularly in the Christian tradition, there were some kind of rock-ribbed people there, I guess you would call them, straight by the book. You know, you anything outside of what it says in the Bible or how I interpret the Bible is evil. It's devil's work. What, was there a concern in that regard? Was there an effort to wipe hoodoo off the scene?
Well, you know, we found as early as the 1860s where there was press conveying stories about hoodoo and voodoo and the dangers of such. There seemed to be from the very beginning this campaign against anything African. And in a lot of regards, we can look at that as what the current racial atmosphere was at that time. Hoodoo was looked at as some sort of savage practice from Africans who wanted to break into people's homes and steal their children. There was a period of time in Memphis, particularly, where there was a campaign by law enforcement to focus on hoodoo practitioners. And there's actually record in the courts and record in local media of where root workers were frequently arrested. And in some cases, their mojo bags, their candles and paraphernalia burnt in front of them. And they were given lectures about how this was some form of foolish superstition.
So in other words, freedom of religion, as long as it's my religion.
Well, yeah, yeah. And again, I, a lot of that we very much can see a line of racist interpretation of hoodoo, because you would frequently see mention of hoodoo and not far behind the mention of hoodoo, you would hear, well, you know, it's like in New Orleans where the voodooists steal babies out of homes and sacrifice, you know, blue-eyed, blonde-haired children. So that theme carried on through the years, and there actually was for a while Bill Street, which became a very popular area for root workers and conjurers and stores that sold paraphernalia. Bill Street had a ongoing relationship with the police where police would come in and raid root workers. And, you know, there we actually have found headlines in newspapers where it says, you know, Tennessee police are warring against hoodooists and warring against root workers. And there just seemed to be this massive campaign. And, you know, I think we, you know, when we look at the totality of it, the reason that focus may have been there is African traditional religion has always been related to power and identity. And specifically in the post-slavery South, you know, there was this sense of any African traditional practice could empower you as an African or an African American. It could remind you of where you came from, and it could keep you alive mentally if you were being placed in this environment and this social system that was very different than what you were raised in. And in many cases, hoodoo is sort of seen as a form of cultural resistance, of being able to retain those things that, you know, were given to you as sacred practices growing up, and where during time, over time, they were being taken away, whether it be by slave owners or by, you know, the current climate in a segregated society.
What a fascinating subject, that of hoodoo. And we'll be back right after this with our guest, Tony Kale. Thanks for listening to the Paranormal Podcast, and I know many of you listen to Campfire, but did you know I have some other podcasts that you can listen to for free, and I hope that you'll check them out. One is called Jim Harold's Crime Scene, and you should be able to find it wherever you listen to this program, whether that's iTunes, your podcasts app, all the various platforms. Jim Harold's Crime Scene. I think you'll like it. We interview people on true crime cases. Everything from serial killers to assassinations. We just did something with a gentleman about Dorothy Kilgallen, who was tied to the JFK assassination in the sense that she was investigating it. She mysteriously turned up dead. So much so, so mysterious is her death, that the Manhattan DA just in the last couple of months has reopened that case, largely because of the work of our guest. Or coming up this week, we did a story on Stephen Avery, who was featured on that famous Netflix documentary, and many people feel is innocent. We had the district attorney of that case who said, not so fast. His opinion is that the truth may be something different than it's in that documentary. You be the judge. Then we've got TV You Grew Up With. What a cool show. I've interviewed the Soup Nazi. I've interviewed Marianne from Gilligan's Island. I just interviewed Eric Braden, who played or plays Victor Newman on The Young and the Restless. He's a legend in soap operas. We've had Don Most, who was Ralph Mouth from Happy Days. Cindy Williams, who was Shirley on Laverne and Shirley. The list goes on and on. Bet you didn't know about that one. Check that out at TVYouGrewUpWith.com or, again, on all those various services. Please check out these free shows. We love doing them, but we can only do them if we have an audience. So we've got to build an audience. So if you haven't heard the shows, check them out. And if you have heard the shows, tell a friend. Thanks so much. And now back to the Paranormal Podcast. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest is Tony Kale, and the subject is his new book, A Secret History of Memphis Hoodoo, Root Workers, Conjurers, and Spirituals. Tony, so I'm assuming because of kind of this war on hoodoo and these really kind of unfortunate attitudes and attacks and so forth, I'm guessing this was practiced in secret a lot.
It was, and in fact, there's a title that's typically given to hoodoo and root working practices on plantations, and that was the secret institution. And hoodoo survived for many years, being basically practiced in the shadows because the public feared it, and because in an attempt to preserve tradition, you know, when we talk about secrecy as it relates to magico-religious practices of any sort, many times we erroneously think that if something's secret, then it's obviously something malevolent being done or some sort of criminal activity. But the truth is that many times secrets, as they relate to religion and magic, are simply there to protect a tradition, and that it is simply there to keep it pure, as pure as you can keep it over time. And so, yes, very much hoodoo was kept secret very much through the years. And but I was interviewing a member of a family who owned a shop in Memphis that offered a lot of hoodoo-related curios and products. And they were telling me that, you know, they said it was sort of an ongoing inside joke that people who would come in, that everyone practiced it, but no one would really claim it. And the proprietor told me that he said, you know, while you may not necessarily be seeing ads in the phone book or have people handing out business cards, there was always that one person in the community, particularly in Memphis, that you knew that if you got sick or if you needed help with love or with getting money, that you would go to this particular home and see this particular male or female that would be able to tell you exactly what you needed to do. So, yeah, it remained secret for years. And again, this is wasn't necessarily to hide anything criminal or malevolent, just to preserve.
When I think of Memphis, I think of music, you know, obviously the blues, B.B. King and Elvis and things like that. Is there any connection or use of music in hoodoo?
Well, there's not necessarily a use of music in hoodoo, but what we did see in Memphis history is how the culture of hoodoo affected blues musicians, particularly on Beale Street. You know, most of us familiar with some of the different terminology in classic blues songs, like, you know, I got my mojo working. Yep. Or I'm using goofer dust, which is basically graveyard dust mixed with different materials to use as components in a spell. We did see that hoodoo and root work affected many of the lyrics that we saw in classic blues songs. And we know that for a fact that we have many famous blues musicians who grew up around root work. And in fact, one of Memphis's most famous female blues musicians, a lady named Big Memphis Ma Rainey.
Oh, yeah.
Her real name was Lily Mae Glover. And Glover was a very well-known root worker. And there are stories of where blues musicians would find her, you know, after her show and seek out services of, you know, rituals and consultations on what specific herbs to use. So we definitely saw hoodoo affect the lyrics and the life of many well-known Memphis blues musicians.
And outside of Memphis, and it's not exactly hoodoo, but certainly when you think about kind of this occult idea, of course, the famous legend of Robert Johnson at the crossroads. And folks, if you haven't heard of that one, I bet you have, but if you haven't, look it up. And it's just really an interesting kind of interplay between spirituality, magic, the occult, and in music when it comes to some of those blues kind of traditions. Interesting stuff. Now, you've researched a lot of this. Do you have a favorite story of hoodoo in practice? It could be something from way, way back, or it could be something in recent day.
Well, you know, in Memphis history, the aspect of hoodoo and conjuring is something that, again, became a very hot issue as related to race relations. Where hoodoo practitioners were again many times depicted as being some sort of, you know, savage, violent individual practicing these heinous rituals. One of the biggest publicly known cases involving hoodoo actually brought a lot of social and racial issues to the table in Memphis. Back in, I think we were looking back in the 40s, perhaps 30s or 40s, there was a lady named Mary Grady in Memphis who was the wife of a local businessman, very well-known socialite, and she had taken a liking to a young African-American man who was a taxi driver, and they began a relationship which carried on for quite a while. And then word started to spread in her community that this African-American man was coming to this white wealthy socialite's house. And again, given the current racial climate, this was not something that was going to be good for this cab driver. And so he decided, you know, I don't think we need to do this anymore. And he sort of disappeared off the radar. Well, it's said that Mary Grady sought out a local root worker and asked the root worker, known in Memphis at that time, root workers were many times referred to as fetishes. And so she sought out this fetish, and he did some divination rituals and inquired of the spirit as to what was going on with this woman and where this man was at. And so the spirit conveyed to him that he was actually under the influence of hoodoo and that he had been conjured. And so Mary Grady was told that there was a woman named Isabella Walton, a young African-American lady, that had put this spell work on him and that the spell had to be broken. So the root worker offered to begin compiling materials to combat this spell that had been put on this cab driver. During this time, Mary Grady grew very impatient, and she sought out where Isabella Walton lived, snuck into her residence, and shot Isabella Walton in the head. Mm. Walton lived, and the word was that it sort of grazed her, although it did, you know, the bullet was shot into her head. This case went to court, and when it went to court, it was dismissed, and the judge's focus essentially was, well, you know, Miss Walton is not dead, so therefore there's no murder here. After that incident, the public reaction to this was of shock and of anger. And ironically enough, it wasn't because that a woman had been shot in the head, nor was it because a root worker believed this woman to have been conjuring this particular gentleman, but because of the interracial romance that had happened. There was such a shock among the community. And this outrage really was a changing point in Memphis hoodoo history, because one of the things it did, not only did it bring the issue of race relations to the table for some, but that it also demonstrated that it was not only the black community seeking out the services of hoodoo, but there were also whites seeking out the services of hoodoo. And so through the years, you know, we've seen a number of historical significant individuals in the hoodoo community talk about how even during the times of very heavy segregation, that many of their clients were from the white community. And so, again, a lot of this really speaks to the history of race relations in the South. And I think it also speaks to the potency and the survival of hoodoo as a practice, even in the face of slavery, even in the face of segregation. And so it's definitely one of the many fascinating stories we talk about in the book.
So here's the tough question. I know that you look at this from a historical perspective, academically, obviously very knowledgeable, but I got to ask you, Tony, do you think that maybe, just maybe, this stuff works?
Well, you know, I guess that's who, it depends on who you ask. I believe that there are certain practices related to magic, related to religion, that if your personal worldview allows for that, then yes, it does work. Interestingly enough, I talked to a gentleman yesterday who owns a shop in Memphis. And he was explaining about how the staff used a money drawing candle as sort of an experiment to see if it really worked. And he said, do you know the day we used it, we had a number of people come in. We had people we never expected coming in our store, and we made a lot of money on that day. Now, did that candle do that? I don't know. I think that in many instances, a lot of the tools, a lot of the practices are very powerful psychologically. You know, we've historically seen in baseball where there'll be a particular athlete who has a lucky pair of socks or a lucky glove they use. So, you know, do these talismans work? I guess that's up to the worldview of each individual. But what we do know is there are practices that have existed for hundreds of years, and many of them are still being practiced today.
Well, that was my next question. What is the state of hoodoo in Memphis today? Is it undergoing a renaissance? I mean, now I would think it would be much more out in the open, much more accepted, maybe even celebrated. Where is hoodoo today?
Well, you know, there are sort of three views on that. There is the first view by some that is sort of a practice of days gone by, and there's not that much of it left. What I've found personally is there are sort of two camps. There are the traditionalists that this has been a practice that has been practiced for years among families. And in many cases, it's not referred to as hoodoo or even root work. It's just a tradition here in the South that, you know, maybe grandmother's remedy or, you know, just something we knew to do because that's how we were raised. So I see the older traditional. And then there is sort of a revivalist hoodoo that's alive and well, and there's a lot of books and mass retailed items that sort of celebrate hoodoo. But you do see a lot of conflict between those two schools at times, because a lot of the traditionalists that I've talked to who have been practicing this for years sort of look at the revitalization of it in some regards as sort of insulting, as sort of a whitewashing of some traditional practices. But again, I'm sure, and we have seen this in anything from, you know, from religion to world philosophies, where there is that I guess, old school versus the new school of thought.
It's really interesting, and I think you do such a good job of representing it and kind of giving us the background on it. I've really enjoyed this discussion. So if people want to learn more, pick up on the book and your work, where can they go and do that, Tony?
Well, the book is available through most booksellers, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. They can also check out our website at www.memphishoodoo.com. And we are also on Twitter at Memphis Hoodoo. And we invite you to look at our site. We're actually in the process of putting together a traveling exhibit of artifacts and photographs and things related to Memphis area hoodoo in West Tennessee. And you can see some of those items on our website there as well.
Well, it's been a great discussion. Our guest has been Tony Kale, and we've been talking about a secret history of Memphis hoodoo, root workers, conjurers, and spirituals. Thank you, Tony.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed this show as much as I did. It was a lot of fun, and I enjoyed the time that we spent with both Steph and Tony, and great information and some spine-tingling stuff. We thank you so much for joining us. We will talk to you next time on the Paranormal Podcast. Bye-bye, everybody. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.